Welcome to the Special Ed Strategist Podcast, where we strategize all things special ed. I am excited to have this conversation with you guys, to listen and seriously grab paper, some pens, coffee, whatever you need, sit back and get ready to absorb this information, coming together and collaborating, cooperating, compromising to come and find a beautiful consensus to better support the children that we serve. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. I am my mom and special educator. I have sat at both sides of that IEP table as a parent and a professional. And over the last 25 plus years, I have made it my passion and mission to help parents and professionals bridge learning gaps, access special education services, and build kick butt IEPs. If you want more tips, show us some love on social at Learning Essentials. If you are new to our podcast, give us a download, a follow, a like, or a share. Let's get ready to strategize special education style. Welcome. I am so excited to have you, Dr. Walsh, on the show. And before we actually hit record on this episode, I did say to Dr. Walsh, it's been a long time coming. So Dr. Walsh and I have been in touch for a bit, several years. We can't exactly remember to have this important discussion today. But before we dive into that, I'm going to have Dr. Walsh introduce herself so you, our listeners, know what goodness is about to come.
Well, thanks, Wendy. Yes, we've known each other for some time, and it's a blessing for me. And well, I'm sure we'll talk about a lot of those things today and what, you know, these, what patients and families are to me in terms of value and what makes my job amazing every day. So my job, I'll tell you a little bit about what I do. So I'm a pediatric neuropsychologist at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. For the past 16 years, I've been there, and my focus is particularly on our patients with brain tumors or leukemias, and also our kids with neurofibromatosis, which is a particular genetic condition that some, actually quite a few children have. Before that, I certainly saw kids with a lot of different kinds of challenges in their lives related to learning, related to social function, related to social emotional kinds of things. So I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about neuropsychology, but essentially what I'm doing is trying to understand children's strengths and weaknesses and how we can build up their strengths and minimize the areas that are more challenging or kind of accommodate or do interventions to do that. So I'm sure we're going to talk a lot more in depth about that, but I think that's probably a good summary of what I do on a daily basis.
I love it. And you are phenomenal at your job. So there you have it. You know, we do a lot of conversations on this podcast about educational impact and supporting children through that special ed strategist lens. And today we are taking it to a different space in terms of the medical model. And so we're going to dive in today about the medical model, but then also how does that relate to the educational model? Because it becomes very confusing and the two worlds do not speak very rarely. So being informed through our discussion today will hopefully help parents and professionals have a better insight on how to bridge that gap.
Yes. Yeah. And I know this came up from us just chatting a little bit, and this kind of sparked some ideas for us to talk about, because I think it is something that's not acknowledged maybe enough and certainly isn't addressed maybe enough. So yeah, I mean, you know, what you and I were talking about that I thought was helpful, and I talked to a lot of parents about this, is that I feel that our medical system, as it were, and our educational system are two very different, I like to think of them as two planets with different inhabitants. And, you know, I think the biggest difference between those two models is one is more preventative or proactive, and one is more reactive. And I'll say at the front end, I'm not trying to put down one of these planets or one of these systems, although I am biased on the medical side, on the proactive side, both as a professional and a parent. So I'm sure a lot of your listeners as parents will say, yeah, we don't like to wait until our kids, you know, have a massive problem before we start getting into action. So to me, that's one of the biggest differences between these models. Why might that exist? Well, I think that actually sadly comes probably down to monetary things, right? So when you think about the medical model, someone might come to see me and their insurance usually is going to pay for them to see me or another physician for some kind of care or diagnostics. And there's a lot of motivation in that world for preventative medicine, right? So we don't want someone to get, you know, have a full-blown diabetes. We want to figure out that we can address weight or other things that might prevent that happening, because obviously once that happens, that costs a lot more. In our public education system, it's really the opposite of that. The funding to a school is going to come once a child has been identified with essentially a failure, that they're not meeting the expectations in that setting. They're not able to meet those expectations. And then, of course, as maybe many listeners may know, there's a whole process involved in determining that, documenting that, implementing that. So the financial support for a school comes then. So you can see already how this sort of breaks down a little bit, or a lot in some cases, between these two settings. So I think those are that's the main piece, I think, that has us struggling sometimes to help our kids, especially those that have different medical conditions or something that's relevant in that space.
And I loved how you frame that, because a lot of what I do in helping parents is guide them through that in the public school setting, the evaluation and eligibility process, because it is a process. There is a timeline. There's a lot that takes place. And oftentimes parents come with that, let's wait and see. So kind of aligning with what you're saying in terms of let's wait and see what happens, because they may not be failing, they may not be struggling or struggling enough that it impacts them educationally. And so parents then are confused because they perhaps did go outside of the school setting, public school setting, and receive some testing, some neuropsych testing, and then they have this diagnosis, or they went to a pediatrician and they have a diagnosis, and then they're thinking, oh, well, I get an IEP, I have a diagnosis. So that medical model and the IEP, how does that look for a family in terms of, I have this diagnosis, but the school system is still telling me wait and see? What are ways that we can bridge that gap between the medical model and the educational model?
Yeah, I think this is a vital point for us as parents to have an understanding about, so that we can be doing the best things for our kids, right? So yeah, again, I think the other difference, right? So you can get a diagnosis, whether it's a medical one or it's something like a learning disability or ADHD. So this doesn't, you know, it can be medical, but it also can be sort of a learning-based weakness. You know, as you know, Wendy, within the school system, the impairment has to be A, significant enough, but it also has to impact specifically the child's functioning in that particular environment of school. And this is, I guess, another difference too, that we didn't talk about when we were sort of comparing these systems, is, you know, in my world, I care about every aspect of the child's functioning, not just at school, but also at home with friends, on the soccer field, whatever they're doing, right? That more whole child or holistic approach to thinking about an individual human and their daily life. And again, this is sort of, I definitely don't want this to sound like a put down of school systems, but the school system is focused on one aspect, and that is within that educational setting. So I have definitely had instances where, I'll give you one of the easiest examples that I run into the sort of this discrepancy with, and that's for any of our children that maybe have a motor deficit, right? So where you might be saying, you know, listen, not only have we tested kind of some of their motor functions or their ability to use the pencil and draw things, that visual motor piece, but, you know, this child's parents are coming in and talking about that. They have a medical condition that, you know, that aligns with, that is often associated with a motor problem. And so we'll be saying, hey, in the school system, this probably affects a child, and occupational therapy would be great, right? And so then you go, a parent goes to the school and the school says, well, we can read Johnny's writing and, you know, we're not seeing this big issue. as it relates to Johnny's day-to-day functioning in his classroom. This is a really hard thing because then they will say, no, we're not going to put occupational therapy in this IEP, right? And then parents will feel very frustrated about this because it's clear that there's a motor problem. So this is one of the easiest examples because this is the one that happens, I would say, most frequently. So part of it is trying to, for me, help parents go, okay, like what we do need to, I think, get our heads around whether we feel like it's right or not is that that school setting is very specific just to that. It does not mean when the school says no that your child doesn't have that challenge. It just means they're not, it's not significant enough in their opinion to provide a service there. So I think for me, I want to try to help parents understand that the school isn't a therapeutic setting, right? Truly, right? And that sometimes the best course is to, and again, I understand there are a lot of limitations to this for some families as well, but the best course is often in those scenarios to go to outside therapeutic settings, right? Occupational therapy that's in a private setting for a couple reasons. One, that you'll actually get what you are looking for, but two, the truth is what, you know, and this is the other thing I get at sometimes is, what occupational therapy looks like in school versus in a private setting is going to be quite different. So often, even if occupational therapy, for example, is built into an IEP, it's a consultative service. It's not a therapy at all. Okay, that we know is sort of maybe we're going to put something on a pencil. We might get a slant board. You know, there's some things that can be plugged in, but it's not really a therapy like we are all thinking about, an intervention to actually improve motor function globally. So I think it's important to understand those differences as well. And to, you know, for me, again, as a clinician and a parent, is like adjusting our expectations of what these systems will or can do as they exist. I think we'd all agree we could talk for hours about how we could improve our public education system in a lot of ways, but we, you know, I always like to ground in like, this is what the systems are at the moment. And so how can we navigate these in the most successful ways for our kids? So I think that's the easiest example, but these kinds of things can happen in other ways as well, whether, again, we're talking about attention or talking about a medical condition that we feel impacts our children on a day-to-day. But again, the school has to then determine if that meets their criteria for, you know, what they'll call an impairment or a disability. But then the second, you know, part B is that it impacts your school day.
That's right.
So that's a tricky one sometimes.
It is a tricky one. And setting those expectations is important. It's critical for parents. And I love how you described kind of what that model would look like, again, with OT in a school setting versus in a medical setting. And, you know, and I tell parents, if you absolutely were looking at that whole child, looking at the daily life, kids are in school for quite some time. So can we, you know, and oftentimes what's impacting a child outside of school is impacting that child inside of school. So it's really setting up that, not argument, but setting a very clear path to what are the impacts for the whole child. And that's why we call it an educational impact, because oftentimes I've seen schools and districts and teams get focused on the academic impact, but let's look at it's called educational impact for a reason. From the time you get off the bus, go throughout your whole day to back onto the bus. And so thinking about, you know, pencil grip, but is it impacting how you're eating your lunch or your times in recess or how you coordinate and interact with your peers? And so really educating, setting those expectations, educating parents on, you know, it's beyond the academic impact, where is that? And then also having that conversation with parents that, yes, you may get services within that school setting, you know, related services, speech and language, OT, PT, but what happens if that provider is not available?
Right.
And, you know, and now recently with our decline of folks wanting to be in education, sometimes school is pulling different staffs to cover classes and it's happening. And so I then encourage parents to ask the question, When was services? When did it take place? Where is it taking place? And ask a lot of those questions so you better understand, are those services actually happening within the school day?
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's definitely important because I think we all know when our kids come home and we say, what happened today? Did you have this, even if it's just a class question, but then particularly if a kid, you know, if your child is someone who should be serving services, it's hard to know based on our kids' report if something happened or not, right?
Right.
So yeah, I agree. Cause we would hope that our child would be able to say, yes, you know, Mrs. Smith came and we did occupational therapy today. Yeah. I mean, listen, you know, this is a little aside from our topic, but I'm sure you work with parents often. A parent is part of the special education team. You are an equal part of that. I don't think all parents understand that. And, you know, that's another thing that I try to sort of, again, educate like you have too, is people to understand that you have the right to ask questions, that you have the right to not totally agree with a plan and come back to the table with it, you know. And so I do feel like many parents feel that they have to sign off, that they have to move forward quickly, because I'm sure they feel pressure to do that because school's wanting to close this chapter up and move forward. But I think it's okay to, again, as you say, ask the questions, get the details, you know, because if we don't, and we just assume it's happening, you know, hopefully that is the case, but we've seen big citywide scenarios where kids were not getting any of the services, and that's illegal. I mean, when it comes down to it, you know, that IEP is a document that protects kids or that 504 plan. And I think that's, again, I think, you know, one of the biggest things we can do to help parents is educate them on all these things as much as possible, their rights, their kids' rights, the expectations, having an understanding, because I think, you know, what we talked about first about understanding these systems and their differences allows a parent to come to that table as a member of that group, to me, in a way that ends up being more positive, that's a bit balanced, because a school is going to respond to a parent in a different way if there's an understanding and there's like, let's problem solve this. I know the differences here. I understand that we're working with two different approaches, but how can we work together to bridge this is different than when I have families that feel I'm looking for all my therapeutic services here at school because my child does have difficulties. You know, that doesn't tend to end up as positive or as much of a team working together towards, you know, helping your particular child. So I do think that, you know, what you're doing every day is such an important piece of this, is educating families on a system that's like very foreign often, as well as the medical system's foreign as well, just to be honest. So I think the more we can get people involved and really help, you know, understand how these work and how we can problem solve them, we're in better space than we were before that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Can medical staff or a team be part of an IEP?
Yes. Now, I don't know that they're necessarily considered a true team member. They're sort of a guest to that process. But yes, you can invite anybody you'd like to an IEP meeting. You know, neuropsychologists who have evaluated children can be part of that. A lot of times, thankfully for telemedicine and Zoom now, we're, I think, more able to. We weren't that able to sort of travel in our car to schools very often, but we've been able to be involved in meetings a lot more where we can speak to our own test results, because sometimes there are questions or a school would like to do additional testing, and figuring out if that's necessary or not can be helpful. But also, I think, again, you know, to the point of these systems, you know, can we bring to those meetings, can we assist a school in understanding what sometimes might be a medical condition that they've never had another student with? You know, the kids that I work with, that's not uncommon, that a school is not familiar with their medical condition, their medical disorder, and how that does impact their daily life, including in the school system. And I'm not even just talking about physical needs. Some of them are, right? Whether there's a fatigue issue and, you know, but even those cognitive and social aspects of a particular disorder, a lot of times school, you know, I think it always tends to get simplified down to the check boxes. And I think actually you and I were talking about this as well, is that very rarely, maybe never, do the patients I work with fit nice and neatly into one of the checkbox categories on the piece of paper that we're trying to complete. So this is problematic because on one hand, somebody wants to check the box and move it forward, right? And there's only so many categories to work with. From our side, often we're saying, well, that's not, yeah, that might be part of the story here, but there's a lot more to it. And so I do think that's a particular challenge to get our, to convey what we need to about, again, this holistic approach to our kids. And, you know, your point about motor deficit as, again, just our easy-ish example, doesn't just affect the kids' pencil to the paper, right? We know very frequently that kids with motor problems are not able to play on the monkey bars. They're not kicking the soccer ball or shooting hoops at playtime. So that impacts a child sometimes more significantly than anything else. So to your point, like, it's not just about that. So many of the kids I see would meet criteria for ADHD, but that is not the whole story. It's more specific than that. But again, that is something that I think we just have to continue to try to educate the rest of the team. Sometimes you'll be successful and sometimes you won't, but I think we keep at that the best we can. We find resources to offer. And again, we try to help parents with that. You know, here's something that's been written for teachers to help understand this disorder a bit better. You know, I always say, it's true of all psychology, like, we can't control all the other people around us. So we have to sort of figure out, what are we going to do? How are we going to navigate this? Even if
it's true in life, right?
It's totally true in life. And
the psychology of life, right?
Yes. You know, I think we're all still working on that, but I think the sooner you understand that the control you have is just of you, then the less distressing it feels, and the more success you can have in moving things forward, because it's easy to get trapped in the loop of, like, I wish these people would just do the right thing, right?
It is. Yeah, absolutely it is. But I think, you know, what I'm hearing and what we're saying now in terms of the medical model and the educational model, you're right. In an IEP, that IEP has little boxes that we have to bloop, bloop, bloop go through as part of a team member. And I've sat on both sides as a parent and a special educator at that IEP table. But we have students that are impacted, like you said, cognitively, socially, physically, and some variation between that, and they don't fit in a box. And especially our older students, middle school, high school, where they have multiple teachers, you really do have to continue with that education, because that's where, unfortunately, sometimes labels that are not part of your student's profile, your child's profile, get put on them because of somebody not understanding the entire picture. And it's tricky and it's complicated and people are busy. And so it's that constant teamwork, collaboration, conversation about your child, which I do understand from a mom's perspective can be overwhelming and exhausting. Mm-hmm. And so really kind of either reaching out to somebody that can help you continue that conversation and be that quarterback, like an educational therapist or somebody, or an advocate that can help do that, or just be prepared that you're going to be having this conversation about your baby a lot. And it's not just at your annual IEP.
Yes, I think that's another great, a couple points you bring up that make me think about other things. Yeah, the system is set up to meet once a year, right? Maybe. Yeah, once a year. And evaluations, not once a year, but when in working with children, there's a lot of development that goes on in childhood, right? And so, you know, that's exactly right. I think it's a very hard additional parent job. But being on top of that, always asking questions, checking in is important, because your child is one of many with IEPs. And to your point, the teachers are really trying to do everything they can for a lot of different students. So they're not going to be checking in on each kid necessarily every day the way that we as parents would. And ensuring that nothing has fallen off, right, in the context. I guess, again, I think to your point, in this current day and age where we're having to pool people to help out in lots of different places, I think it's more likely than ever that things are getting skipped here and there, or that something has shifted and now all of a sudden this isn't happening anymore on a regular basis or whatever. So I think that's important. And if I can go back to sort of the sort of checkbox part of this conversation, this again would be another difference for me in how I'm operating in a medical space versus an educational space. So it's sort of, I'm going to align diagnostics with this categorization in an educational setting. Diagnostics to me in a medical setting is extremely important. Not that to put labels on kids, because I kind of am pretty conservative with that, but to get it as right as possible. The reason that matters to me is because if I have, again, I can give a good example of a case that this falls into. If I have a child that's come in and the parent's question is, does my child have ADHD or does my child have anxiety that's making him or her look like they have ADHD? Because they can look very similar. It's really important for me to figure that out, whether it's one, the other, or maybe both, because some kids really do have both. And that matters because what I'm going to do next is dependent on that, right? So if I get it wrong and I say, I think this kid has ADHD, but in fact, they have anxiety. And then I send the parents like, let's go get some treatment for ADHD. Well, I'm probably wasting a lot of time because that's not really going to do the trick. The child is still going to look like distracted and things because I'm targeting the wrong thing, or I didn't figure it all out, you know, or vice versa. So to me, with the educational system set up the way it is, the same thing really aligns, right? Because if you're checking the box for ADHD, or you're checking the box for autism, or you're checking the box for, you know, the best other health impaired, but there's some general associations with those check boxes, right? So I have now a standard set of accommodations or interventions I might do based on what box got checked for you. Those probably align to some extent, but like, again, I think what are we missing here? It's just, it's an overly simplistic system for humans who are pretty complicated, truthfully. Now, having said all this, it sounds like I'm saying this is terrible and this system doesn't work and what, you know, we should be mad about it. No, I think, again, it's the recognition of how it works. And then what do we need to do as professionals to help parents or parents to help our kids to go, I understand this now. And now I need here's how I might need to navigate this in a different way or educate more or ask for different kinds of things. And I think, again, we as professionals can be helpful with that, you know, and trying to figure out what are some other alternatives that aren't just the standard. What do we need for this particular child to function well in this setting? It's not straightforward or easy, but we can try.
You know, and it's critical as you're talking about diagnostics. You've listed ADHD, anxiety, you know, brain tumors, all of that. If you think of the educational side, that IEP, the federal law, gives you 13 categories.
Yep.
And those from ADHD, anxiety, brain tumor, and some other ones would fall under other health impairment. So right. As a special educator, if I receive on my caseload a student that has OHI, it's my due diligence to dive deeper to see, okay, what does this look like? Because those three things I just listed look extremely different, and they're extremely different for each child. And so, kind of back to your lens, how do you help parents? Well, I know you educate them on, you know, being very thoughtful in terms of that diagnostic component to help kind of give a brighter picture of what is happening with that student. In terms of recommendations for the school team, do you write goals? Do you recommend goals? Do you have accommodations? What would be the best way as a, again, if I'm looking through a parent lens to say, all right, I'm between these two worlds. Mm-hmm. I'm having my child educated outside of the school system, or evaluated, pardon me, outside mm-hmm. of the school system. What can I seek to help better paint, you know, with a broader brush of what's happening with this student so that I can then articulate it to the team in a way that's going to give the best outcome for my student?
Yeah, I think, you know, within the context of doing a neuropsychological evaluation, you know, diagnostics is one piece of it, but what we're really trying to understand, like I was saying at the beginning, is the whole profile of a child. Everybody has strengths and everybody has weaknesses, right? And how great those are, how extensive those are, again, everybody's unique. And sometimes, again, our kids that have different backgrounds from a medical perspective are going to have multiple areas that are more challenging for them. So we're looking in our profile for this pattern of strengths and weaknesses. The diagnostic piece is sort of the final trying to really pulling it together, but that's not the most important piece of information in that report. It is helpful in some context, but to your point, three kids with ADHD are not going to look exactly the same. They have similar symptoms. That's how they are diagnosed, but they are still unique individuals. One might be very hyperactive. The other might be predominantly inattentive. That's two very different needs that those children would have. So within the context of the evaluation, I'm looking for the hows, right? I'm looking for how does this child manage this particular set of tasks? Maybe it's a memory test. Maybe it's an attention test or an executive function test. If they're good at it, why? If they're not very good at it, why? Right. So again, even the data itself only tells part of the story, right? And you know, if anybody's had an evaluation, hopefully what you've also gotten with that is the qualitative observations of the neuropsychologist within that testing. Sometimes that's one of the most important pieces of the evaluation, honestly. Again, another example, if I give a reading test where I'm asking kids to read single words, right? One of these tests is not timed. So I can get two children with the exact same score on this test. But if I look, if I recorded them both, you could see two very different scenarios. You can see child A going, reading right through this list of words like it was breathing. And then you can have child B, since this test is not timed, taking 20 minutes to do the same list of words as child A did in 3 minutes. Now that's important, right? Because what those kids look like in a classroom is drastically different. Even though if you looked at their score, you'd be like, they should look the same in this classroom. So to your question of like, what are we doing with all that? I think myself and other neuropsychologists try to be very specific about what a child needs based on this level of data analysis, I guess, or understanding that child. So to me, child B definitely needs more time for reading, right? And probably some intervention on fluency, right? Now, hopefully I also did a fluency test to document that, but, you know, and child A, maybe their difficulties are with comprehension and not reading the words at all. So what they need is totally different. So then we're really trying to, the best we can in that moment, align our recommendations as specifically as possible for that child. Now, I will say sometimes that creates challenges in this crosstalk that we've been discussing today between these systems, because sometimes I think I have really great ideas for recommendations for these children. I'm like, do this and we are going to, you know, I think this will really make a difference in their life. And the school sees that and goes, you are so out of touch with what's available at this school. Nice try, right? And this is really actually a challenge for me as a professional, is to try to be specific about that child, but at the same time fit into what's available. And that's not an easy task. And that's where the collaboration between myself and the parents comes from the most, is because I'm saying, listen, these are all ideas I have. Some of them are going to jive in the school system, or we can take it and tweak it to be this, but how it can work there. And some of these may not. And we're going to maybe find a different way to do this intervention or help our child in this way outside of that system. But this is one of the biggest challenges. And I think, again, we try to be very thoughtful. To me, I have, you know, as a neuropsychologist, I have so many audiences and people I'm trying to, I guess, help. First and foremost, I want to understand your child as, you know, intensely as possible. And I want to give you as many specifics as I can at this moment for what can be helpful. But I'm also trying to tweak that so that my report's not thrown out the window in an IEP meeting because a team feels that I don't have any clue what is possible at school, right? So it's a real interesting, you know, challenge for me. But I feel that when parents and I talk together, then a parent can say, oh, you know, they actually have this resource room and I bet we could do these things in there. So I do rely on parents to give me feedback on what does your school look like? What's the setting? What's the team mentality, et cetera, so that we can fine tune some of these things together. But that's where we're coming from in terms of trying to be very specific with our recommendations.
When I think it's also, I love what you do and your reports are succinct and clear and guide parents, but a lot of that is what the essence of what you do is in terms of, again, educating the parent and help guiding them of what to do. And I would think you can also prioritize, you know, if you say, all right, I see these list of things, and then the parent can help guide and prioritize so that the team as a whole doesn't feel overwhelmed, right? So if you walk in and you're like, here's 30 things that we're going to do, well, A, it's hard to measure, right? What are we doing that's actually working? So let's prioritize. And I think that's where that parent input statement when it comes to an IEP is critical in terms of where do you see your child in 3 months, 6 months, a year? And then I always encourage parents, how about 2 years, 5 years, so that you can start thinking ahead, getting on list if you need to, in terms of getting additional services that are provided through federal funds that may not be available right now, but starting to get on the list. So I think having that understanding and prioritizing really helps. How do you help parents translate that quantitative, that why? How do you help them then take that knowledge? Because it's, you know, a diagnosis is scary. It's, you know, confusion, it's fear, it's worry. And parents don't want to fall into a pigeonhole or these limited opportunities for support when it comes to their baby. And so how do you help parents translate that why in a way that the school system's going to go, oh, okay, I can see this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's telling your story. Mm. I mean, you know, the way I get to know about my patients as they are to me and these kids that are in my office is partly that as we've talked with the parents and they've told me the real story, right? Sometimes with a lot of tears because there's stress and there's pain and there's worry about your child and your child is struggling at often when they're in my office, things are usually not going great, right? There's a concern or there's a, you know, a worry. That's how I get to know the depth of this person, right? And then I'm, you know, I find that what I'm doing is taking, so a parent might come and say, these are the things we're worried about. This is what we're seeing every, you know, on particular days. These are where the challenges are. And then I can take my test data and my observation. And again, I only get one good day usually with kiddos. So I'm, you know, certainly don't have the depth of knowledge of a child that their parents do. And to me, that's a really important piece that I say to parents, like, you are the expert on your child. I know that systems are out there that want my signature on something, but the truth is, and I'm okay being the parent's voice. That's how I see myself. I'm not really the expert on this child. I might be able to and often pull things together to help understand how did these two behaviors that seem very separate, actually those go together. So I think that's where my value is for parents is putting the pieces together that you've brought me to make it more manageable, more understandable how these things go, and then how that understanding can alter how we're going to respond to address the concerns that we have. But, you know, so to me, telling your story, and again, some people are not going to affect them to hear your story. I find that hard to understand, but that is true. And this is back to our point of like, we can't make everybody feel our feelings, right? But we can try. And so I do think that's the part where it's like, yes, this data is helpful, but it's not the core of what we need to be getting at or understanding about our kids. And I do think parents having an opportunity to tell the story like they tell me is very, it's very important whether somebody's going to decide you're the expert on your kid or not. I think if you can know that in your own, you know, heart, then that's okay. But that's definitely how we can, I think, convey more about each of our kids and their uniqueness and say, I understand this is a system that needs to classify, but can we do that and also understand that this is, does not wholly explain this student, my kid.
That's right. I've got a couple questions here. So how do we open up resources for parents that are available with a given diagnosis, or not even, like, where could a parent start to better understand resources, whether it's within the school or outside of the school, once they're given a diagnosis?
Yeah. I mean, I think for a lot of the kids that we see that are medically involved, it's in some ways easier, although I hesitate to say that these days. I feel like it's very hard to access resources, especially mental health resources right now. It's a real problem, honestly, and something that sort of bothers me on a daily basis is that even as a practitioner, I sometimes have trouble getting people connected with what they want. But you know, your physician teams and your psychologist, you know, anyone you're working with is a good place to start. But I will tell you, I think where parents get even more than they get from us is in these parent communities or these disease specific communities, or, you know, different community. And I hesitate to say that because I think you do have to be careful from an online perspective. I think there's a lot of, you know, things that can make people feel worse or is not particularly helpful. That might be a group online that's really not offering assistance, but just kind of a space to get more negative. So I think, you know, again, professionals can help with what organizations are out there, but I do think, you know, in our neurofibromatosis community, it is amazing how the parent community helps. And this isn't just statewide, this is nationally. They have really come together and it's such a positive. I see the benefits for not only the child and the family, but again, I think then as people are local to each other, one parent saying, hey, I, you know, this person was fantastic for some behavioral therapy for my kiddo that had autism or my kid that had ADHD or some other challenge. So I do think that's one of the richest areas. So then your next question would probably be, Karen, well, how do we get connected with those people? Right? Nice idea, but how do I do that? And I think, again, you know, for me, this might be a little too limited, but for me, I know where some of these parent resources are based on brain tumor, neurofibromatosis. And so I think getting with, being with specialists, they often are very aware of this. But even if you're talking about a child who has no medical background, they've been diagnosed with ADHD, and it's a pretty straightforward situation, there are national organizations like CHAD, right? And they do have parent group offshoots from these nicely known organizations. So it is a little bit about searching for those things. I would, you know, not so much Facebook related things, but these organizations that have been around a long time that are well established or recognized and have a history of really being positively impactful for families. I think these are places that we can start. But again, every family's unique. So I try to offer those specific recommendations to families based on our time together so that I can help guide them at least in a direction that's getting at something more specific. I do think it's challenging to just get online and start searching if you're, you know, a family that's not so connected, but I would rely on your providers to help you with that. And it's okay to ask. Like, I think people are afraid that they're bothering somebody, right? And Wendy, you know, it's like, I always tell people, please just reach out to me. Please do not reach out to me, because I can give you something pretty quickly. You're not bothering me ever. And still a lot of people don't reach out, and I know they probably could, right? But, you know, we really mean that. It's not that cumbersome for us to answer a question, to, you know, lighten the load a bit for families. That's why we're here. We're here to try to be helpful. So it's okay to really reach out to your providers, whether it's a pediatrician you know, a nurse practitioner, an oncologist, it doesn't matter. I think everybody is there to try to be helpful.
And, you know, I think as a parent, it's incredibly important to have these support groups, because sometimes when you receive a diagnosis, it feels isolating.
Yeah.
Because, you know, your friends, you know, your adult peer groups or whatever don't seem to have their children going through that. And so by having that network that you can turn to talk about resources and ideas, and you don't feel as alone as a parent, and that is incredibly important to navigate this process, again, between that medical world and educational world, because you can ask parents that have already gone through, or even, you know, only a step ahead of you, but they can say, this worked really well. And then you can say, okay, this is how I need to do it. So it gives you a platform to ask questions, to learn additional things, and then have that connection, that community, so you don't feel isolated coming from this place of fear and love with your own baby.
Absolutely. And somebody's always ahead of you, and somebody's always going to be behind you in the process. So it, to me, it's a very beautiful system, because you get help from somebody, but then you also are able to give it. And it's just such a nice, it ends up just being a really valuable community, and in a way that you can engage regularly where you may not feel that you can do that with your providers. Right. And again, it's different. I do not have a child with any of the conditions of the kids that are in my office. So while I feel that I can understand many things, I know in truth, I don't know the reality of a parent's experience. And that's important to acknowledge, but other parents will have the true, you know, the true feelings and experience that you have as had as a parent. Again, whether it's something that feels very serious or seems less serious. It's all serious. It's your child, right? It's all important. It's all, and you know, there's one thing is not worse or better than the other. It's all your own experience of trying to make sure your child is good, is going to go, you know, we always talk about the goal of all this is that this child is going to go out into the world one day on their own and live the life that they want to live. And that's the goal of all of this, right? Is can we get them from here to there, whatever the challenges are, and we're trying to keep them moving in that direction.
We all know that great things happen when there's data, right, to reference. Can you talk a little bit about the testing report? We've kind of mentioned it throughout, but how can reports be used to set up a student for better outcomes in school?
Yeah, I mean, our intention, right, is, and I say to parents, this report is a tool for you. So I always tell them, if something doesn't make sense, if you're reading this and you're confused, you need to get back with me, because my job as a professional is to present the information in a way that is understandable to you as a parent, and to a teacher or a school system, and to the physicians that have referred your child to me, perhaps, right? I think over 16 years, I've got a pretty good system now, but, you know, reports can look a little different, but I would generally say they have the same components, right? So they're going to talk about the history of that child, because that's important to understand risks or other things that might have impacted their development. You know, we will then summarize, and what we're looking for in our testing is themes and data that kind of, what we say, hangs together. So one bad score on something isn't really important. So we might say, hey, that happened, but guess what? The fire alarm went off during the testing, and this is, you can kind of not worry about this particular score, but we're going to put together the story. This is the story of this kid. These are the strengths that this child has. These are the areas where there are more challenges or difficulties, and this is how those are impacting his or her life. Then after that is, you know, perhaps if there's diagnoses to make, those should be included in the report. And then should include any and all recommendations that we think are going to be helpful. I think your point, Wendy, earlier is very important too. And I've started really trying to do this with families over a number of years now of prioritizing. Because I think, again, as a clinician, we realize I was trying to be helpful with giving you 600 recommendations, but realize that is not always that helpful. So paring those down, you know, I feel like we were trained to believe that more is better, but I don't feel like that's always the case. So I have definitely worked with parents to say, listen, I know this is overwhelming, because the reports are overwhelming. right? Even a relatively concise one like mine, including the data tables, is probably 12 to 14 pages long, right? So it is overwhelming. It is a lot to take in. I do this every day. So I understand these data points. I understand what I'm saying. Most people don't do this for a living. So it is really important that I'm as concise as possible, that my recommendations are as meaningful as possible and as specific as possible. But even then, I'm still going to have a good bit of things in there for you. So I have said to parents, listen, there's a lot here. These are not totally prescriptive, right? These are ideas to pull from. You're not going to do all these. Some of them you may never do. You may try one, it works, does not work so well for your child or in this circumstance, but you know, my second one works better. So I do try to say these are all a bank of ideas that we can, you know, you as a parent can partly look through and go, I know this is not going to work for my kiddo because we've tried that. Okay, great, right? Like, leave that alone. But then I say, here are my priorities, right? So if you have a child with anxiety and ADHD, and I don't know which one's worse, I'm probably going to say, let's look at, here's what we're going to do first, because if we treat the ADHD, that's going to help us understand what's going on with the anxiety. So let's start there, right? So I'm going to prioritize like the top 3 to 5 things. And in some instances where there's a lot going on, I might say, we're going to start with these 2 things. Let's get that going and then circle back to me. Then we'll come back to where we are at that point. I also try to help parents with their education meeting, right? That I recommend parents, you know, if there's 2 parents, sit down together and say, out of the things I've said, what, especially if you've tried some of these at home and you know they work, write these things down. Go to this meeting with your top 3 requests. What's the most important to you out of maybe these 20 things that we're trying to address? You won't do them all at one time and neither will the school. But if you can go in with a pretty focused agenda and say, you know, this is the outcome of this evaluation. We know it's a lot, but we'd like to, for us, the priorities are A, B, and C. Can we just start by talking about those and how we can implement different supports or interventions around these particular 3 things to start? And then we'd like to have another meeting in 3 months to talk about how those are going and what additional things we might be able to plug in then on some of these other areas where we're concerned about, but maybe we're not in the top 3. So I think by breaking that down, it seems very reasonable to schools. It seems like you're trying to work with them and not come in with the list of 30 and they're going, you people are crazy, right? Like, we can't do all this stuff. So I do think, you know, by a school feeling like you understand the boundaries that they have to work in or the limits that they have based on the system can be a really nice, positive, collaborative that ends up getting your child what they really need. So I do think that's an important part of that process of going in and trying to really be a team member as much as possible and with some what feel like reasonable starting requests, right? I think you can get further with that than other approaches.
And it's not overwhelming.
Yeah. And again, for parents, it's overwhelming to get my report, right? I mean, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, what is all this? And then of course the end of the report will have an appendix with all this data. And I've shifted, you know, it's interesting, Wendy, because over the years I've shifted my approach to writing reports, how I've reported certain things. And I try to get feedback from families on this to do better because, you know, there's been different strategies I've had over the years. I think some have been more successful than others in how I convey what I know and what I've learned back to the family in that written document that is meant to be a tool for them to go to their pediatrician or to their school or to whomever to say, I want you to know my child better. This document does it. And I can also speak to that. I want you to be able to speak to the document if I'm not there. So it is really important for me that it's a comprehensible document that you actually feel like you can navigate in a meeting.
I love
Hopefully
that.
I do okay on that.
You do. I've read them reports. They're phenomenal. So kind of as we wind down our conversation, what did I not ask? What did I not know enough to ask?
Well, I think you're pretty on target with it. You've been involved with me for a long time. So I think you, listen, I think you actually have a very unique perspective in terms of what you do and also our engagement together. But I think, I guess it's not necessarily what you didn't ask, but it is one of the questions I know that you do sometimes ask. But what I think I'd like to say to parents and I think is really important is trust yourself and your instincts about your child and understand that you are probably doing way better than you think you are. You know, this is usually my parting words to many families is there's a lot of fear in families that I've missed an opportunity. I didn't pick up on this thing, or I didn't go do this or get this assessment or do this intervention. And now we're here. And I really don't allow my parents to do that to themselves because we're all humans. Your instincts are better than you think. And so I think it's important to follow them. I do think that many parents are surprised when I say, actually, you're doing a bunch of things I would have told you to do. So you're doing amazing. You understand your child. You're intimately connected with that other human. And I think more parents are doing all the things that are helpful without even realizing it. They think they're coming to me for an overhaul. And usually I'm just saying, we just got to tweak a couple of things. We have this beautiful foundation of love and support, and you're adjusting to your child without even realizing it because of being connected as a parent. So it's not even something you didn't ask, but something I think is really important for parents to take away when they work with me is that it's all okay. You know, we have not destroyed our children by starting an intervention 6 months later. We haven't. If anything, there are more beautiful things going on within families than they realize, and more things that have actually promoted that child's development. And I love that part of my job to say, you are actually doing a beautiful job with what you're doing. And I'll help you tweak a couple things or problem solve a couple things. But to me, that's a big message for families, particularly with kids who really are struggling or have, you know, very significant histories of having medical or learning difficulties, because it's not easy. It's very stressful. It's very hard. You love them and you want them to be okay, but you're doing great. I will say that.
I hope that folks that are listening just take this little clip of and just make it their daily mantra of Dr. Walsh saying that, because it is true. It's, you know, again, you're from that fear and love. And when you're in it, it's hard to step back and look at that 30,000 view to say, whew, what am I doing it? Am I doing it right? And I think that could go to any parent, regardless if there's an impact in any way. What would you kind of, as we close out, you gave some insight for parents. What would you say for either educators or professionals? Any tips in terms of bridging this gap, you know, back to the title of what we're talking about in terms of medical and educational?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we all get very busy in our positions, right? And it's, I think you have to work hard at being present with the person you're with. Now that's easier said than done, right? Particularly, I think, for teachers who have a classroom of 30 kids. So I don't know, I don't have the solution to this, but I think trying to, if it's an IEP meeting, be as present as possible in that moment about that child, or if you're a physician or you're a psychologist, keeping all the distractions out so you can really hear what a parent is saying about their child, to really be listening. Now that's easy for me as a psychologist to say, because it's literally my job. But I do think that's the important part, is really being present and hearing, because again, the value for me and what helps me understand this child and maybe what they need doesn't always come from my data or a report or a piece of paper. It really comes from the human experience of sitting down with a family with that child and feeling what they feel a little bit. So that, I think that makes the connection of like, I'm invested in you now. I'm feeling this fear of the parent, or I'm feeling this concern. I'm with that child and I can feel their nervousness in when they're trying to perform. Like, to me, that, I guess it's put yourself in somebody's shoes. I find that to be the most valuable data that I ever gather is I'm able to help you more if I feel like I can at least remotely understand where you're coming from, and true of children too, because I think what I hope I've been good at doing is helping parents also understand that behavior is actually related to anxiety. So even though it seems very oppositional, let me explain what I felt with your child and what I experienced in working with them, because then, you know, how I'm going to interact with that behavior is very different, right? If I feel like somebody is being oppositional, but then, or I understand that that's driven by an intense anxiety, I'm going to respond to that in two pretty different ways. One is much more likely to be positive and beneficial to the child. So I do think the putting yourself in somebody's, you know, boots for a little bit is a really important interaction to have with another human in general.
Another life lesson.
Life lessons by Karen Walsh.
Well, Dr. Walsh, you are such a gem, and I hope that this podcast, this episode will help bring clarity and support for, again, parents and professionals that are working with our students on a daily basis and working with their own child. So I am so grateful for your time.
Well, it's always my pleasure, and happy to have another conversation with you anytime you wish.
Not for a couple of years though. We're not gonna wait that long.
No, absolutely not.
Thank you.
Thank you again for strategizing with us and spending your precious time listening. If you've loved what you've heard, give us a like and a follow at Learning Essentials. Looking for free tips? Head over to learningessentialsedu.com and you can download free tips to prepare for an IEP meeting, plus bonus questions to ask. I am your host, Wendy Taylor. If you need more special education support, visit Learning Essentials, where we provide an individualized and systematic approach to supporting students with various learning needs and differences through academic coaching, educational therapy, and BrainCamp, our executive function support model. If you are a parent, I've got you covered. Head on over to learningessentialsedu.com and I can walk you through that IEP journey. Mm-hmm.